There it goes. Hey, good morning, campers. How are you? It's awesome. Sun's shining. Beautiful day. A question for you. How do you introduce yourself? When you meet somebody new or you go to a party or you're at a social gathering with people you don't know, how do you introduce yourself? A better question might be, how do you identify yourself, right? Often the way we introduce ourselves tells us something about who we think we are in relation to what we believe about our identity, right? Or we might believe how we introduce ourselves defines us because we make associations. See, in all the different circles that I travel in, I'm known as something different. To my friends and family, I'm known as Ryan, or Shockey, as many people just call me. When I'm here at church, I'm often called, and there should be some pictures thrown up on the screen here. Here's the family, right? Okay. There, I'm just Ryan or Shockey. When I'm here at church, I'm often called Pastor Ryan, though I prefer just Ryan. When I'm teaching my college courses, I'm called Professor Shockey. That sounds weird to you, doesn't it? Because we don't associate that with each other in that way. But when my students, I'm called Professor Shockey. I once spoke at a Catholic gathering, and they introduced me as Father Shockey. Now, that was just weird. I was like, I'm sorry, but I'm not giving up my wife, all right? Someone else can speak, and I'm too into that kind of thing. But how I introduce myself often defines what it is I think about myself. There are times when I travel a lot, and I know me. When I travel, I like to be left alone. Believe it or not, I can be somewhat of a loner. And I like my time. And I give all the signals that I have zero interest in talking to you, right? I put on my Beats headphones. I'm looking down into my book, and I'm not making eye contact with anybody. But it always happens there's that one person who just really, really wants to talk, right? And so whenever I want the conversation to end, because they always ask this question, what is it that you do, right? And so whenever if I just am not interested in talking to anybody and I just want the conversation to end, when that question comes up, I tell people I'm an ordained evangelical evangelist. And that ends the conversation every time. No one wants to talk to the evangelist on the airplane, right? However, if I'm more engaged and not feeling so, you know, spiteful or whatever, or not so introverted, I'll tell people that I work with high school and middle school students, and I teach college courses. And then they usually engage, and then we get to the conversation about church or that kind of thing. Have you ever had to explain what it is that you do? See, even if you're a doctor and you tell somebody that you're a doctor, they'll ask you, well, what do you practice, right? Or if you're a lawyer, they might ask you who you represent. Or if you're a teacher, they'll ask you, what do you teach? A study by the Pew Research Group found that women, when you introduce yourselves, what is it that defines you? What do you immediately talk to other people about? Your family. It's always about your kids or your brothers and sisters. For the most part, the majority of women, when they're asked, who are you, they identify or they associate themselves with their children, with their family, or some sort of societal upbringing. Men, we are much more shallow, right? What is it that we often talk about when we introduce people or when we introduce ourselves to each other? Sports is number two, right behind our job or our career or profession. It's what I do that makes me who I am, and then we go right into sports because that's how we associate. Now, sociologically, this tells us something about ourselves, does it not? We like to be identified. We want to be known. We want to be recognized. In sociology, the word is this, the Gemeinschaft, all right? Gemeinschaft. Turn to each other and say that without spitting on each other. Gemeinschaft. Got that? You just spoke German. Good job. Now, what this is just simply means that my family is a group that I associate with. My church is a group that I associate with. Who I play ball with is a group that I associate with. My fantasy football team is a group that I associate with. And all of those different groups speak into my identity. They all have a belief about who I am in that sociological setting. And so each one of those groups helps to define me. So who I am at church and who I am at work and who I am in school might be the same person, but it might not be, right? Have you ever noticed that, or somebody else has noticed about you, that your personality changes a little bit when you go from group to group to group? Like you're more extroverted over here, more introverted over there? Well, why is that? Because at the core of who we are, we have an identity crisis. When you have, sociologically, we know that you travel in 6 to 7 groups. The average person has about 6 to 7 different groups that will define their Gemeinschaft, that will kind of speak into their identity. So I want you to think for a minute, what are your 6 to 7 groups that speak into your identity? Are they good? Are they healthy? Are they beneficial? So think about that. Who is it that speaks into your identity? Now, this directly relates to what we find happening in the church in Corinth, because the church in Corinth had several groups that were speaking into their identity, that they find themselves in the middle of an identity crisis, that they had forgotten who started them, they had forgotten where they come from, and they had no idea where they were going. So we find this church in turmoil because of this very principle. And so Paul in 1 Corinthians 9, we're going to be in 9, 1 through 18 today, so you can look in your inserts, it'll be on here, go to your Bibles, wants to explain his role so that there is clear association of who he is to them and who they are to him. And he starts with this. Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen the Lord Jesus Christ? Are you not the result of my work in the Lord? Even though I may not be an apostle to others, surely I am to you, for you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. See, this church had forgotten who started them. Paul started this church. He nurtured this church. And because he was gone for a while, this church decided to take Paul off the payroll. Well, see, Pastor Jeff just went on a cruise down somewhere in the Caribbean. So while he was gone, you all should have just taken his check and deposited it into my account, right? He went around, right? So I should get, right? You agree? He's not nodding his head. It was better in first service when he wasn't here, right? I could say more. Don't listen. I wasn't there the week before. I was vomiting my guts out. Sorry, not to be gross, but so what? Then you just take that wage away because someone isn't present? Well, that's what this church was doing. They had an identity crisis. They forgot who started them. They forgot who their leader was. And Paul basically is saying to them, you are like a child to me. You're my baby. I started you. I nurtured you. I'm your apostle. I've spoke to you. I saw the Lord Jesus. And because of that, I came to you and I planted a church here to be with you. You are like an infant to me. See, this church cared more about the wages than they did the work of the gospel. And Paul cared more about his work than he did the wage that he was getting for it. As I was doing research for this sermon, I studied and I found that there was this church in Texas, who I'm not going to tell you the city or the name, but when they just had their annual business meeting like we did just a few weeks ago, their board sat around and figured out how much they spent over the past year per conversion that happened in the church. They wanted to know how much it cost them to get somebody converted to Jesus Christ. Sick. Is there too much money you can spend on a relationship like that? That's your value? Oh, we need to cut it down 1,000. Really? Really? That's what you're focusing on? That's what this church was focusing on. We're spending too much money converting others. We need to keep more of that money for ourselves. Not spend so much out there helping people, helping you. We need that money internally. That's what this church was doing. They were choosing the wage over the work. So Paul says, this is my defense in 3. To those who sit on judgment on me, do we not have the right to food and drink? Do we not have the right to take a believing wife along with us? And do the other apostles and the Lord's brothers and Peter? Or is it only I and Barnabas who lack the right to not work for a living? Some of the people are in judgment on Paul because he hadn't been around a while. And so they said he didn't deserve sustenance. He didn't deserve food or shelter or clothing. Or even if he came to that church and found a wife, they didn't believe he should take a wife from their congregation because he hasn't been there. Because he was out doing the Lord's work. He was out with other people. So they sat in judgment on him. And Paul says, you know what? I chose the work over the wage. He continues by saying this. Who serves as a soldier at his own expense? Now, how many of you have fought in a war? Have ever fought in a war? Raise your hands. Anybody in this room fought in the war? Okay, we have a few. Jim, did you have to buy your own plane ticket to get over there? No, you didn't, right? Who fights in a war at their own expense. When you go to war, you don't have to buy your own plane ticket to get there. Or who plants a vineyard and doesn't eat its grapes? Who would plant a vineyard and then go buy grapes at Kroger? Or who tends a flock and doesn't drink the milk? Any dairy farmers? Milk your own cows, and then you sell all that milk, and then you have to go buy it from somebody else? It doesn't make sense. And that's what Paul's getting at. It just doesn't make sense. Doesn't the law say the same thing? For it is written in the law of Moses, do not muzzle an ox while it is treading out the grain. Is it about oxen that God is concerned? Surely he says this for us, doesn't he? Yet this was written for us because whoever plows and threshes should be able to do so in hope of sharing in the harvest. And here's the statement. We have sown spiritual seed among you. Is it too much if we reap a material harvest from you? If others have this right of support from you, shouldn't we have it all the more? If we've sown spiritual seed among you, isn't it right that we should have a material benefit from that? They were so concerned about money. They were so concerned about money. They were so focused on wages that they missed the whole point. They were missing the work of the gospel because money became their priority. The wage became the focus over the work. And so Paul had this attitude, and he finally wraps this section up with this. But we did not use this right. He had the right to go in and demand payment. He had the right to go in and take food or drink or whatever from the church. But on the contrary, he says, we put up with anything rather than hinder the work of the gospel of Jesus Christ. He was more concerned about the work than he was the wage. So it brings a question to us today. Are you more concerned about the work or the wage? Are you more concerned about the work of the gospel here or what you get in reward for that work? Are you more concerned about your recognition for the work that you do? Or are you more concerned about just doing the work of the gospel? I had an awesome opportunity yesterday. I went up to Holland, Michigan to talk theology with a person who has his PhD in Augustinian theology from the Roman Catholic perspective. And he and I sat and talked theology. Now I know like two people in this room are like going, oh yeah, that sounds exciting, right? Yeah, great day. What I didn't tell you is that he's actually the husband of one of my past students from Oregon. His wife, Rhonda, was in my youth ministry in Oregon. They've moved to Holland, Michigan. He's now a professor at Hope University up there, Hope College up there. And we got to revisit Rhonda. I hadn't seen her in years. And we talked about old times in Oregon. We talked about Jeff and told some stories about him. We talked about a lot. It was good to be there. It was good to see her again. She's now in her late 30s. She's having her fourth child. And it was good to have that connection. It reminded me that when I die, I don't want somebody to say that he was in the ministry for the money. You don't go into the ministry for the money, trust me, all right? What I want people to say is that he passionately loved teenagers. He passionately loved teenagers. That's what I want to be said, that he loved teenagers. And seeing Rhonda yesterday reminded me and reinvigorated me of that passion to care more about the work than the wage. Second, Paul cared more about people than he did the power. In 13, he says, do you not know that those who serve in the temple get their food from the temple, and those who serve in the altar share in what is offered at the altar? In the same way, the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should receive their living from the gospel. Now, this is a great passage for Jeff, Roger, and I, and Rick, who used to be in vocational ministry, because it supports this whole concept of the vocational ministry amongst many other passages. And really, this whole sermon could be just preached on that, but as I dug into it, I found that there were better principles that applied, and it was this thing that Paul chose people over power. See, Paul had the power to go into the church and demand to get food from the temple, demand to get wine from the cellar, demand shelter, demand housing, and he chose not to do it. We don't like to be forced, do we? We don't like to be forced into anything. In fact, we spend a lot of time and money to make sure that we are not forced to do anything. Yet Paul chose the people over his power and his right to be able to go to them and demand payment. And in 15, he comes back around to this. But I have not used any of these rights, and I am not writing this in the hope that you will start doing these things for me. For I would rather die than allow anyone to deprive me of this boast. I would rather die than have anybody say that I was in ministry for the glory or I did this for my glory. It's kind of like what Roger talked about last week. Sometimes the better choice is not to practice your freedoms, not to exercise your power. Or William Booth says it this way. Think of it. Think of this. The greatest of a man's power is the measure of his surrender. The greatest of a man's power is the measure of his surrender. See, here's the reality. If you have freedom, if you are given freedom, and you have to exercise that freedom, you're not free. If you are given freedom and you have to exercise that freedom, you're not free. If you are given freedom and you have the ability to restrain from exercising that freedom or that power, then you are free. As I was writing this and as I was doing this part of study, our preschool was in session, and Becky Shreve and Lori Lockman were back there, and I heard this little kid, I don't know whose it was, so I can't tattle on him, but I heard this little kid saying, no, it's my turn to be the line leader, right? You remember those days? You want to be the line leader or the playground monitor, right? Or the lunchroom person that wrote down anybody's name who talked and they had to write sentences and it was always me that had to write those stupid sentences. You remember that? You had to be the line leader, and these women so graciously understood what this boy was doing. He was making his case for his power and his turn and his right. And I don't know which one, if it was Lori or Becky, but they looked at him and said, no, in fact, you're not the line leader. Today, you get to be the caboose. And I thought, how beautiful. How beautiful. You get to be the caboose. Sometimes when we exercise that power, really we find out we're really not that powerful at all. And sometimes when we choose not to exercise our power, we realize how much power we have. Now, I could have shown anything. There are tons of stories that showed people exercising their power to step over somebody, you know, to get that job or get that title or get that promotion. But instead, I found this video clip which shows two police officers who decide not to exercise their power because they choose people over power. And this says it beautifully. Would you roll this? Check this out.
Remembering 60 years back is hard for anyone. But for Melvin Amrine, the groom in these pictures, it's especially challenging.
Did I invite you to marry me or did you ask me?
No, you asked me to marry you.
Was that right?
Melvin was diagnosed with Alzheimer's 3 years ago.
Some of that is kind of lost.
For his wife, Doris, it's been hard to watch. But she says something happened recently to remind her that the man she fell in love with is still in there.
It's special because even though the mind doesn't remember everything, the heart remembers.
Okay.
It happened the day before Mother's Day, when Melvin, who normally needs help just walking around the block, turned up missing.
See a white male by the name of Melvin Amrine.
Police dispatch here in Little Rock, Arkansas, put out the call.
He left the house walking approximately 40 minutes ago.
They eventually found him 2 miles from his house.
Police say they get these calls every once in a while of an Alzheimer's patient out wandering aimlessly. But this one was different. When the officers approached Melvin, they say it was clear. He was a man on a mission.
It was absolutely a moment of clarity for him.
Sergeant Brian Grigsby and Officer Troy Dillard say even though Melvin didn't know his address or where he'd come from, he absolutely knew where he was going.
I mean, he was pretty adamant.
He wasn't going home until he got those flowers.
Flowers?
That's what he wanted. He wanted flowers for his wife because tomorrow was Mother's Day.
Melvin had bought flowers for his wife every Mother's Day since the birth of their first child, and he wasn't going to disappoint her now.
We had to get those flowers. We had to get them. I didn't have a choice.
So after telling dispatch they were taking the man right home,
and there's a Kroger's,
the officers secretly stopped by the grocery store. Surveillance video shows them helping Melvin pick out the flowers, and when Melvin came up short at the register, look who slipped the cashier the difference. Meanwhile, back at home, a very worried wife was about to get the gift of a lifetime.
As he came up those steps, and I saw those roses and the smile on his face, I mean, I just broke inside. I just said, thank you, thank you, because I saw his heart.
Amazing what's possible when love becomes an instinct.
Wow, huh? Write that down. When love becomes an instinct. Amazing what's possible when love becomes an instinct. Now I realize I just ruined Valentine's Day for every man in this room. You can't be that romantic. Sorry, guys. Those officers could have done their duty, exercised their power, and just took him home. But they chose to listen to Melvin, and they chose people over power. And did you see the power that choosing people over power had? It changed a life. And Paul said, your church, you guys are too focused in Corinthians on the power. Start thinking about the people, because that's what matters. And lastly, the last one, testimonies over titles. In 16, for when I preach, I cannot boast, since I am compelled to preach. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. If I preach voluntarily, I have a reward. If not voluntarily, I am simply doing my job, or as Paul said it, discharging the trust committed to me. What then is my reward? Just this, that in preaching the gospel, I may offer it free of charge, and so not make full use of my rights as a preacher of the gospel. Paul had to preach. He was compelled to do it so much that it became his identity. And to this church in Corinth that had all these outside influences trying to direct it, trying to guide it, trying to give it identity, Paul said, I came to you and I preached just Jesus. I have to do this. This is who I am. If I preach, it's my duty or vocation. It just flows out of me. It is my ekonomon pestudeme, all right? You don't have to say that or remember that, but it is my identity. It is who I am. It is everything that I am. All my identity is wrapped up in this, that I choose that the people and my testimony as a minister of the gospel, not in my wages or my power or my title. Paul chose his testimony, his duty to preach, even though they weren't going to honor him with that, over the title that he was given. There are all kinds of examples in the Bible of people who choose titles over testimony. Remember Moses and Pharaoh, right? Pharaoh, it's a good title, right? Ruler of all of Egypt. That's a pretty good title. Imagine if you had that. Ruler of all of Laporte. Good title, right? But at the end of the day, all Pharaoh had was a title. Moses had the testimony. Do you remember King Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel, right? King Nebuchadnezzar had king. Now that's a good title. I would love if somebody would make me king, just even king of that half of the building. But I don't have the title king, right? But king's a good title. It's a really good title. And Nebuchadnezzar tried to force people, right, with his title king to exercise his power to get people to bow down to a false god. And at the end of the day, Daniel refused. And Daniel had the testimony. Nebuchadnezzar had the title king, but Daniel had the testimony. Now, for all you women in the room, you're not excluded, right? There's this lady named Queen Jezebel. Any queens in the room? Any women like to be queen? Yeah, the queen. Yeah, it's a good title. Queen Jezebel, probably not so much, but queen's a good title. And she had all these people who would do anything that she would want them to do. And at the end of the day, all she had was the title, and Elijah had the testimony, right? He was the one who was faithful and was solid to God. And here's the reality, and I love the way Dr. Benjamin Reed says this. At least I think it was him, but here's the reality. You're going to die, right? Encouraging, right? I know. Let's end on a good note. But you're going to die. We're going to take you out to the cemetery, drop you in the hole, and come back to the church and have potato salad, right? It's what we do. We're going to do it. Just true. When you were born, you were the only one who cried, and everybody else was happy, right? When you die, we will all cry. Question is, are you going to be the only one happy? We'll gather around you, and chances are we'll talk about your work, the people you impacted, and the testimony of your life. But chances are, few, if anyone, probably no one, will remember the wages you earned, the power you had, or even the title you had. Just won't remember it. You know why? Because it just doesn't matter. So what defines you at the end of the day? Are you chasing the title or are you chasing the testimony? Let it be said that they might have had the title, but let it be said of you that you had the testimony. They might have the title, but you have the? They have the title, but you have the testimony. Amen.